You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
So, just by way of introduction, we have been tracking through this book of Exodus, seeing that there is a Pharaoh on the throne who is infanticidal, homicidal, slave-owning. He considers himself to be a god. Just about every bad attribute you could ascribe to a person, you can describe to this particular man. And after 10 plagues of judgment on the Pharaoh, God, one after another, finally Pharaoh releases these people, the Israelites who were slaves, and sends them out to go to their land, which God had promised 4 centuries earlier. So at this point, the naive reader might think that everything is going to end happily ever after. Let's pick up in chapter 12, verse 35. We read that the Israelites did as Moses instructed and asked the Egyptians for articles of silver and gold and for clothing. So they just went through the Egyptian stuff. We're like, I'll take that and that and that necklace and that cardigan and that sachet or whatever. I don't know clothing. But they went through and they just took. And the Lord made the Egyptians favorably disposed toward the people, and they gave them whatever they asked for. After these 10 plagues, apparently you get a different attitude toward the Israelites. So they plunder the Egyptians. This is what we call back pay or payback, depending on how you look at it. They deserved this money. They had paid for it with blood, sweat, and tears. They were slave labor for centuries, and now they're leaving out in the desert. They have nothing. They have absolutely nothing. And so they took a bunch of booty as they left. Verse 37. That night, the people of Israel left Ramses and started for Sukkoth. There were about 600,000 men, plus all the women and children. So just the men, but then you got the women and kids, and a rabble of non-Israelites went with them along with great flocks and herds of livestock. 600,000 men, and this is repeated too. Numbers chapter 1, right around 39, 40, somewhere in there. 603,000 men, plus the women and kids. This would put us up to 3-4 million people. Are we to believe 3 or 4 million people were leaving Egypt? Woodstock was 500,000 people. This is 6 to 8 times that amount of people. That's an enormous amount of people. Just to put that in perspective, bigger than any ancient army. Herodotus says that Xerxes' army was about 1.7 million. Darius III had an army of 1 million. There's 4 million Israelites leaving Egypt. Why did they leave? Why didn't they just turn around and fight the Egyptians if they were this big? This is an innumerable number. God called Israel the smallest nation. How's that fit with this whole picture? Deuteronomy 7. I didn't choose you because you were so big, but there are 3 or 4 million. That is big. That's freakishly big. But God himself says, you're not the biggest nation. That's not why I chose you. So too, we see indications from the text itself. For example, when they go out into the different oases to get water, sometimes, God will provide for the people later in the book of Exodus by having Moses strike his staff against the rock and there's a supernatural well that's, created. Other times, it's just an oasis, a pond. And 4 million people, and then we have to think about all of the human waste and food. Think about Woodstock again. Let me go back to the 1969s. And to think about, you've got that many people there just for a week. And just how if you ever read the literature on that or the documentaries, it was just filthy hippies everywhere. And we got 6 to 8 times that amount of people living in the desert. The water supplies, later we're going to read that Pharaoh sends how many chariots? 600. And all the other ones too. 600 compared to... I've got my doubts. This number is that big. What do we do? Are we saying that Moses, when he wrote this, that he was wrong, that he exaggerated the numbers? Some commentators say that so that they could worship God more. That's what we call lying. That's not hyperbole. That's lying. So no, that's not the answer. My answer here, if you had to really skewer me on this, is that this is most likely a transcription error. Now, let me be clear at the outset. The Jewish people were scrupulous, meticulous, for the way in which they copied the Hebrew scriptures down throughout the centuries. I can't even go into all that. However, I will say at Cave 1 at Qumran, they found the entire scroll of Isaiah, Isaiah 1:1 to 66:24, and it was almost identical in word, with only a handful of words being different, from the scroll that existed during the time of the Masoretes about 1,000 years A.D. So an 1,100-year period, they had copied and recopied that scroll so perfectly that only a handful of words were wrong. So I don't mean to give the impression that a transmission error is common, or even that we're seeing something here that should shake our faith in the slightest. This is the exception, not the rule. When we come to Numbers, it's not the transmission of the Hebrew text in general. It's specifically numbers like this, like 600,000. John Wenham and also Walter Kaiser, who were two Old Testament scholars, they say that when Aramaic documents were being copied, they used not only words to represent these numbers. They also used different dashes and slashes, strokes. Think about how you tally something on a whiteboard. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3. Or Roman numerals. You have different letters. Well, these strokes, you know, to put down the numbers, wasn't just a 000. Instead, it was just these different strokes of the pen. Very easy to screw this up. Or if you're looking at a document that's 100 years old, to read the previous scribe's words, was that a stroke or was that just, you know, him, I don't know, a piece of dirt on the paper? It's very difficult for this to transmit. And we see this in our Bible. There's nothing new about this. This isn't news. This shouldn't make, you know, somebody a best-selling author if they wrote a book about this. We've known this for centuries. For example, we see cases where the numbers get added. So 2 Samuel 10, it says that there were 700 chariots. The chronicler, however, says there were 7,000 chariots. So he added another exponential of 10 there. 1 Kings 4, it says that there were 40,000 stalls. 2 Chronicles 9 says that there was 4,000 stalls. So you might say the chronicler was updating and exaggerating the number from 700 to 7,000. No, because in Kings to Chronicles, he drops the number. This is accidental. That's all this is. 2 Kings 24, Jehoiakim the king was 8 years old. 2 Chronicles 36 says he was 18. I could go on and on. 1 Samuel 13 says that Saul became king when he was 1. That's 12 months. That's 52 weeks. And you read your Bible, it says 30. They throw in 30 because they're like, that's just not right. We know that's not right. You don't become king when you're 365 days old. Anyways, I think this number is quite smaller. How much smaller? I don't know. I think this is a case of transcription error. Not that Moses got it wrong, but the later scribes did. And let me just say real quickly, this is different than saying that God made an original error in the text. We're not impugning God with error. We're impugning scribes with error. Way different. That's the difference between God creating Adam and Eve in a fallen state versus Adam and Eve falling later on in history. That's what we're seeing. All right. Verse 40. Now the length of time the Israelite people lived in Egypt was 430 years. At the end of those years, the very day, all the Lord's divisions left Egypt. Jump into chapter 13, verse 17. When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, though that was shorter. Whoa. Instead, we read, God said if they face war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. So there's a straight line to get out of Egypt, but he doesn't send them that way, even though it's a shorter path. Instead, he takes them on this long, circuitous route we're going to see later. Why? He's hatching a plan that if he doesn't do it a certain way, these Israelites are going to look back and they're going to say, we should go back to Egypt. And indeed, that's what we see. We see it in this very text. Later, we see it in Numbers. Why can't we go back? The meat was so good and the food was so good and the slave labor wasn't that bad and the whippings weren't that bad and throwing our baby boys into the Nile River wasn't that bad. They have this almost like a Stockholm syndrome for Egypt. And they're looking back at this saying, we should go back. And God's like, I'm going to create a plan wherein they're never going to go back. So we read in verse 18, God led the people by the desert road toward, not the straight route, but toward and right into the Red Sea. The Israelites went up out of Egypt ready for battle. At this point, critical scholars will say this isn't the Red Sea that divides off with the Sinai Peninsula into two separate realms. But this is really at the top of the Red Sea. You can see it here. There's the Red Sea. This is actually what should be described as the Reed Sea. The Reed Sea. The language is the same. So if we're trying to figure out, did they go through the Reed Sea? Kind of like a few inches of water, but marshy, full of reeds, to the very north of the Red Sea. Did they go through there and get their feet wet? Or did they go through the Red Sea, the Red Sea? Well, the language is the same. It's the Red Sea or the Sea of Reeds. We can't adjudicate or pick which is the correct interpretation based on the language, because you call the Reed Sea, or the Red Sea. Which is it? Well, I'll give you the correct answer. It's the Red Sea. For one, if it's the Reed Sea, the Sea of Reeds, how is it that Pharaoh's army drowned in 6 inches of water? They all came rushing back in and they laid down face down in the water. No, never happened. How could there be a wall of water on the right and a wall of water on the left, as we're going to read in the 14th chapter, 22nd verse? That doesn't sound like the Sea of Reeds. Finally, 1 Kings chapter 9, verse 26, Solomon built ships in the Red Sea. He didn't have little toy boats, people. He had ships. He created nautical vehicles to go out into the sea. This is the Red Sea. I don't buy the whole Sea of Reeds thing. It's not what we're reading in our text. Verse 19, Moses took the bones of Joseph, because Joseph had made the Israelites swear an oath, God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones with you from this place. This is showing further connection with Genesis. Genesis 50, verse 26. Even though Joseph could see right then and there, we're supposed to be here in Egypt, we're only going to be here for a temporary amount of time. I know eventually we're supposed to belong in Israel. After leaving Succoth, they camped at Etham on the edge of the desert. By day, the Lord went ahead of them in a pillar of cloud to guide them on their way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light so that they could travel by day or by night. Neither the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night left its place in front of the people. So this would be the ultimate GPS. Wherever God moves in the cloud, you follow. Wherever the fire moves, you follow. And this would have been incredible to have that nice cloud covering with the UVs coming down in Egypt during the day, and then at night you got the fire, nice and bright, very clear. What is this describing? God is clearly leading these people. He's moving out ahead of them. He's guiding them. He's in front of them. We know he's leading them. The question for these people at the time is where? Directly buttressing up against the Red Sea? Chapter 14, the Lord said to Moses, tell the Israelites to turn back and camp near Pi Hahiroth between Migdol and the Red Sea. They are to encamp by the sea, directly opposite of Baal Zephon. This, in the words of Admiral Akbar, is a trap. These people don't have ships. They don't have ship. They don't know what a ship is. They can't swim. Ancient people were not taught how to swim, especially when you've been living in sand for 400 years. You get near a body of water, that would make you tremor and shake. We can't swim. This is lethal. We don't know anything about how to use a ship or anything else. These guys are in trouble. So let me wrap all this together here. The plan that made perfect rationalistic sense was to leave Ramses, go east-northeast. What we read in chapter 13, verse 17 is called the road through the Philistine country. Isn't that a straight shot? Anybody thinking about going to Florida and first we're going to go to Texas and then we're going to go east over to Florida? No, you just go straight across, and there's Jerusalem right there, straight across through the land of the Philistine country, straight across. If they had their maps at the time and their cartographers, they would have said, we got a clear route right to the promised land. God says, no. First, I'm going to take you to Baal Zephon. Well, where's that? We don't really know. But it's right on the border up against the Red Sea. This is a bad idea. I hope you can see that. This is not a good route. In fact, you're leaving Ramses in Egypt. not even escaping. Now you're going right up against the water. This is trouble. I hope you can sense what it would feel like to be marching, following Moses right out there, only to see we've hit a dead end, a roadblock. God says to Moses, Pharaoh will think, however, the Israelites are wandering around the land in confusion, hemmed in by the desert. See, this is something you would think as an idolater, as somebody who is into pantheism and henotheism and polytheism like Pharaoh, where the deities themselves were capricious. The deities were confused. If you're talking about Geb or Anubis or whomever, you see that they are just kind of like big humans. So Yahweh is leading the Jewish people out. Well, he's confused and the Jewish people are confused. Well, yeah, of course, because their God is confused. So to Pharaoh, this would make perfect sense. Once you get out of the land of Egypt, you don't know what you're doing. You might as well just come back to Papa and stay in Egypt forever. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his officials changed their minds. And they said, what have we done? We've let the Israelites go and lost their services. That's a very politically correct way of saying, we just let all the slaves leave and we're committing a genocide. We are going to lose our economy. Not only have we been humiliated and all of our deities have been defaced and shown to be defunct, but now we're actually going to ruin our entire economy. We got to go back. We got to get them back here. So Pharaoh had his chariot made ready and he took his army with him. He took 600 of the best chariots along with all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over them. The Lord strengthened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, so that he would pursue the Israelites who were marching out boldly. The Egyptians, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and horsemen and troops, pursued the Israelites and overtook them as they camped by the sea near Pi-Hahiroth, opposite of Baal-Zephon. So they catch up with them. It would not have been hard. These people are wearing sandals, for goodness sakes. These Egyptians, however, are showing up with chariots. These were the tanks of the day, you know, the F-22s. They just chase them down in no time. And there, they're stuck right by the water. Picture this in your mind. Picture this. I know sometimes as you listen to the Bible taught, there's a barrier between you and the Bible. But I want you just to read this for yourself. Imagine you're standing there by the sea and the people that had whipped and beaten and tormented you for generations, they're marching after them. You're looking up over the horizon. What is that? 600 chariots. All the chariots of Pharaoh. And all the men are coming to hunt down the Israelites. They're terrified. This is just abject terror. They start to cry out to the Lord. And they said to Moses, was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die? What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? You know what they call this? Sass. It's sarcasm. Indeed, we know that 75% of the Egyptian territory was devoted, in a religious sense, to the dead, to graves. This is basically saying, coming from a land full of tombs, what, there wasn't enough room to bury us all out there? Well, didn't we say to you in Egypt, oh, here's some revisionist history here. Weren't we telling you this the whole time? Leave us alone. Let us serve the Egyptians. It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert. They never said that. That conversation never happened. Now, filled with fear and terror, all of a sudden they're reinventing what happened, and we should have just stayed there the entire time. Well, here we have two mutually exclusive predictions of the future. From the human perspective, they're looking at the future and they're saying, this is all wrong. We should have gone east, northeast. In fact, we never should have left. And all we're walking into here is a trap and we're all going to die. Meanwhile, God had promised these people after 400 years, I'm going to take you out of slavery and I'm going to take you to the land that I promised you. So it makes you wonder, if you've got the human prediction of the future on the one hand, and you've got God's promise and prediction of the future on the other, which are you going to choose? Well, for Moses, he chose the latter, not the former. He turned to the people. He said, do not be afraid. Stand firm, and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians that you see today, take a good look. You see them? You look at them. You're never going to see them again. These people that have been hurting, harming, torturing you for generations. They tortured your dad and your grandfather, right? These people, I want you to get a good look at them. You're never going to see them again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still. What do we read here? Do not be afraid. I wonder why he opened up his speech to these panicked people who are ready to flee with this opening imperative. Do not be afraid. It's because fear can distort the facts. Fear can distort the facts. All of a sudden, we got God's promises over on this side of the scale, and yet we got our fears over on this side, and what wins? Our fears every time. We've got reality over here on the side of the scale, and we've got our fears on that side. What wins? Our fears. Our psychology, it always trumps whatever's happening in reality. And so Moses says, get a grip. Do not let your fear conquer you. Instead, you have to conquer your fear to think straight, to think clearly about what we're about to do. Number two, stand firm. Their fears were distorting their ability to make wise decisions. You're going to go back to Egypt. That's your plan. That's your plan. You're going back to Egypt. And then what? Oh, we're just going to live there for another four centuries. Clearly, that is the idea of an insane person, because we know this is not a life worth living to be there. And God has moved heaven and earth. He's brought the plague. How many more plagues did he need to bring for them to realize he's on their side? No. Our plan, we got a really good plan. We're just going to jump ship. We're going to run. Stand firm and the Lord will fight for you. Their fears were distorting God's character. Yes, he brought all those judgments on the Egyptians, but now that we're out here, he's bringing us here to die. That is not God. God doesn't do that. God is not rescuing his people just to capriciously kill them in the desert. This is so out of touch with reality. That's what fear does. When you are stoked with fear, all of a sudden you are totally disconnected from reality, facts, the promises of God. Any kind of wise decision making, what you need to do in these moments is hit the freaking pause button and say, stand still. Stop. Stop jerking around trying to think of how to fix this problem that is fully and completely out of your control. You can't control this. You don't have the human resources to deal with an army from Pharaoh. So stand still and get the fear under control. Well, Moses stood up pretty firmly to the people. Not so with God. He, good leader, you know, in front of the people, he kept it together, but then he turns back to God, and we read that God said to him, why are you crying out to me, Moses? So he must have gone back to God and been like, those people were really scary. Why are you crying out to me? Tell the Israelites to move. Raise your staff. Stretch it out with your hand over the sea to divide the water so that the Israelites can go through the sea onto dry ground. You catch this? This is the first time God let Moses or anyone else in on his plan. At this point, Moses is like, I know God's going to fight for us. Either he's just going to, you know, waste all these Egyptians. He's going to produce some boats. I don't know. Maybe he's going to airlift us over the sea. I don't have a clue. All I know is God is going to do something. Moses could see the logic, in other words, that God wouldn't move heaven and earth to get the Egyptians out of Egypt just to see it all end right there. Here, God lets him in on the details. I'm going to open up the sea, and you're going to go right through it. This barrier that you think is insurmountable, I'm just going to snap my fingers, and I'm going to open it right apart. People say, well, seas don't move apart like that. That's not scientific. True. It's not. Yeah, we're not saying that it naturally split apart. That's stupid. Nobody believes that. Nobody believes that seas just move apart. Otherwise, we'd be seeing this all the time. What we're saying is that this is a supernatural miracle of God. The God who created the universe out of nothing. This is no more difficult for him to open up the sea than to create a universe. Like if you ask me, is it more difficult for God to understand calculus or algebra? Dumb question. He's omniscient. Neither are more difficult. Well, is it more difficult for him to create the entire universe or to part the Red Sea? Neither. Neither is more difficult. He is omnipotent, all-powerful, omnipotent. And he's going to just blast this sea right apart using Moses. So let's go back to our map here. We saw that their plan was to go straight to Jerusalem. This was fraught with problems, though, not the least of which, the Philistines. The Philistines were there. Instead, we see he took them right up here, and then he says, but we're going to go across. And then we're going to go down to the Sinai Peninsula, and then eventually, we won't get to this until Numbers chapter 13, to Kadesh Barnea. Verse 18, the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I gain glory through Pharaoh, his chariots and his horsemen. Then the angel of God, who had been traveling in front of the Israelite army, withdrew and went behind them. The pillar of cloud also moved from in front and then stood behind them, coming between the armies of Egypt and the Israelites. You see this? So you guys are the Red Sea. So we got the Red Sea here. We got the mountains on one side and on the other, and they turn around to see the Egyptians. And they're like, oh, fudge, all right? They're coming for us. What are we going to do? And God moves the angel of the Lord, that's Yahweh himself, coming down to block, and then the cloud. So the Egyptians are like, we can't get through. Perfect, perfect safety. The Egyptians couldn't come behind. They couldn't go over the mountains. They surely couldn't go through the angel of the Lord. They were perfectly safe here. Throughout the night, the cloud brought darkness to the one side and light to the other side, so that neither went near the other all night long. There was no crossing between the Egyptians and the Israelites. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and all that night the Lord drove back the sea with a strong east wind and turned it into dry land. The waters were divided, and the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground, with a wall of water on their right and on their left. The Egyptians pursued them, and all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and horsemen followed them into the sea. Think of the chutzpah that would take to be an Egyptian soldier on a chariot and be looking up and seeing wall. The Red Sea is deep. It is deep, and see these walls of water, and straight ahead, we're going to get them. During the last watch of the night, the Lord looked down from the pillar of fire and the cloud at the Egyptian army, and then he threw the Egyptian army into confusion. He jammed the wheels of their chariots so that they had difficulty driving. These were the F-22s. These were the tanks. These were the things in which the Egyptians were putting their power and hope. And they ended up being the greatest liability in the middle of the Red Sea. The wheels don't work in the middle of a sea. And finally, the Egyptians said, let's get away from these Israelites. The Lord is fighting for them against Egypt. Okay, yeah. After 10 plagues, after a couple months, I mean, it's probably 2 months in Egypt, 10 plagues, one after the other. People are bailing out like crazy, like, get us out of Egypt. The officials, Exodus 8:19, this is the finger of God. God is moving. And then finally they leave, and now there's walls of water. That doesn't happen. And then, nope, you know what it was that pushed them over the edge? The chariot wheels. It was the chariot wheels. Verse 26, the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea so that the waters may flow right back over the Egyptians and their chariots and horsemen. Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and at daybreak, the sea went back to its place. The Egyptians were fleeing toward it, and the Lord swept them into the sea. The water flowed back and covered the chariots and the horsemen, the entire army of Pharaoh that had followed the Israelites into the sea. Not one of them survived. Ancient people were never taught how to swim. We've got a few reports from history. Alexander's army, few of them knew how to swim. When a boat went down, that was it. And these waters came crashing back in, and these guys were judged. This is a corporate capital punishment. Why? Because they deserved judgment. That's why. These were slave-owning, infanticidal, homicidal men intent on bringing an entire ethnicity into slavery. And they were judged. And I know people say, well, I've got problems with that. That's your problem. I don't know what to say. If we can't allow God to judge infanticidal, homicidal, slave-owning people, I don't know what to tell you. Well, we finish up in verse 30. That day, the Lord saved Israel from the hands of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians lying dead on the shore. And when the Israelites saw the mighty hand of the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord, and they put their trust in him and in Moses, his servant. What we're seeing here tonight is a narrative which is showing us God's leadership of his people. What are we to learn from this? For one, we're seeing that the people could not see God's plan the way that God could see it. Indeed, there were many parts of God's plan that the people were just completely ignorant of or distorting or just not thinking about. Like what? Well, the fact that God was guarding the people. The Red Sea at their backs, the mountains on both sides, the fiery cloud. See, they thought that this territory right there at Baal Zephon, right by the Red Sea, they thought that was a trap. Actually, because the Lord had taken them there, because they were in the will of God, this was the safest place they could have been. Let me repeat that in different words. To be in the will of God is the safest place to ever be. This doesn't preclude the fact that you're going to experience fear. Sometimes people say, well, I know I'm in the will of God, but I'm afraid. That's okay. God never promises that the fear will not be there. The fear may very well be there. That's not the issue. Guarding them. Yes, I've seen this in my life. I haven't seen God always remove the threats, the suffering, the menacing, hurtful stuff. He doesn't seem too preoccupied with that. But what I have seen him do is guard me and sustain me through it. In other words, to put it in the context of this passage, God didn't just eliminate the Israelites. What he did was he carried them through those fears. This is part of God's leadership in your life. You could be sitting here right now saying, I'm going through a time which is especially scary. That has nothing to do with whether God is still good and whether you're in God's will. Don't run. Don't be a runner. Stand still. Let the Lord work. Wait. Wait for him to move. And you will not regret that. You're in the safest place you could ever be. What else could they not see about God's plan? That he was judging the Egyptians, though not in a way they expected. He had done the more clear and overt judgments in the 10 plagues, of course. Here we're seeing something different. See, the Israelites were correct in saying that this was a trap when they were put up against the wall at the Red Sea. Where they were wrong, though, is that it wasn't a trap for them. It was a trap for the Egyptians. God was using this, and they had misperceived it. They thought God was coming for them. Oh, God, you're here to kill us. Why would you kill us out in the desert? Oh, whining and screaming, crying out, ready to bail and go back to Egypt. And God's like, you are minutes away from seeing me come through. But it's a trap. Yes. Yes, it is. But it ain't for you. And we see this repeatedly. God will take you to a place where you think, God, there must be something wrong here. I don't know why you put me in this situation, and yet God will carry us through these times. Once we get through to the other side, your faith surges. You wouldn't believe this. Can we wait? Can we trust? Can we believe that God is good during these times? What else was God doing that the people couldn't see? He was blocking re-enslavement permanently. There is no going back. They keep saying, we want to go back. You're going to see this as we go through the book of Exodus. We want to go back. We want to go back. There is no going back. You can't go back. Not an option. The Israelites would have opted for this if they had the choice. I've seen this in my life too. Yeah. There's been times where I remember when I first came to know the Lord, it was November of 04. I prayed to receive Christ into my life. And I remember just feeling a sense of peace. Like, man, that's done. I felt, as C.S. Lewis used to put it, he called God the hound of heaven. I felt like God was just chasing me down. You know, I want to come to know you. And I finally surrendered to that love. You ever done that? Surrendered to the love of Christ into your heart? Yeah, very powerful, very awesome. My experience was peace. But then the next day I woke up and I was still me. That was the problem. I mean, the biggest issue in my life in eternity was solved. yet I still had all my problems. And I saw one time after another where I was going to go for one bad decision after another. I can't get into all the gory details here. It wouldn't be appropriate. But I would be moving in one direction, you know, full steam ahead, and all of a sudden, inexplicably, God would just block it. I'll give you one example. Yeah, I probably should. It was bad. It was bad stuff I was trying to get into, and all of a sudden, God would just come in and say, no. And I'd be like, this worked before. I could always pull this off before. No. And then I'd try something else. No. I'm not saying God blocked me from every bad decision I was going to make. That'd be a completely stupid thing to say. I'm saying there were key moments where I was going for it, and God just said, no. There's no going back. You cannot do that. And we can trust that God loves his sheep. We're the sheep. We're the stupid animals. God is the shepherd. And he will guide us, and he will block us in various ways. I don't want to overstate that point, but I hope you can hang with me there. God is very good at loving us, even when we're acting very foolishly. Finally, God was doing something most important of all, which was to bring these people to faith. As we read in our concluding verse, when the Israelites saw the mighty hand of the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord, and they put their trust in him. Yeah, this is what God's all about. He's all about faith. Faith just means trust. God had shown himself to be trustworthy, worthy of trust. It wasn't until the end when they saw all this that they were like, we're with him. And maybe you've been coming around to Bible studies, and you've been studying about the person and the work of Jesus Christ. And you're starting to see that he is real. He is who he claimed to be. And he is trustworthy. The question for you is, are you going to have the same reaction to his rescuing work in your life? Which is what? Which is to work harder? Which is to follow the Ten Commandments? No, they didn't even have the Ten Commandments. That's not till chapter 20. What did they have? What did God want from them? Faith. And that's what God wants from you. He could have asked for anything that he wanted. Instead, what he wants is for you to trust him and to say, I want you to rescue me through the person of Jesus. And the Bible says if you do that, he will always answer that prayer. He'll always take anybody who says, I want to come to know you. You could do that here with us tonight. Well, as we wrap up completely, is God leading you in a certain direction? Maybe as we were studying, you could sense there's certain things in my life I feel like God is leading me toward. Haven't decided yet. I guess I would leave you with a couple questions. Are you fighting him on this? There is a reality in which we can fight God. God gives us the freedom to tell him no. I wouldn't recommend it. To be in God's will is where you want to be. If God is telling you something in your heart, leading you in a certain direction, don't say no to that. Do not do that. Trust that God's will is good, pleasing, and perfect. Good, pleasing, and perfect. Being in God's will is good, pleasing, and perfect. You will not regret following the Lord in whatever path he takes you. I'm not going to say it's going to be easy or without suffering or without fear. That's not what we're reading here, are we? What I'm saying is it's going to be good and it's going to be the best and it's going to be perfect.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.